numerous fields of employment associated with the automobile industry. For more information on HFCC's Associate Degree Program in Automotive Technology, contact Instructor Gary Hines at 313-845-6350. That's Instructor Gary Hines at 313-845-6350.
Think you have what it takes? We do. Henry Ford Community College. Visit us online at hfcc.edu.
Hey, this is Stone Perkins. Do you know what my favorite time of the week is? You guessed it, Saturday nights from 8 until 10 right here on WHFR for Five Gears in Reverse. It's an alternative music show that features new indie and even plays older alternative tracks that go all the way back into the 1960s. You'll find it all here, punk, blues, indie, ska, garage, and a whole lot more. So why don't you join me Saturday nights from 8 until 10 for Five Gears in Reverse. Maybe I could make it your favorite time of the week too. Until then, keep it locked right here for all of our cool shows on WHFR 89.3 FM and on the web at WHFR.FM.
Each week on Light from the Underground, we turn the spotlight on songwriters. You'll hear music that crosses genres so that you can hear the widest variety of music. I'll dig through all the new releases we've received to find the best new music for you. Some of the artists you'll hear include lesser-known artists like Matt the Electrician, The Hold Steady, and Daniel Martin Moore. We'll also mix in classic artists making new and creative music like Graham Parker, John Mellencamp, and Robert Plant. But it doesn't stop there. You'll also hear new sounds from artists making a go of it right here in Michigan, including Ralston Bowles, The Wayward Roots, and Jill Jack. Check out Light from the Underground on the 2nd and 4th Saturdays at 10 a.m., on 89.3 WHFR.FM, we're making waves.
The following program has been pre-recorded. The views expressed by the participants are not necessarily those of WHFR Radio or Henry Ford Community College. Welcome to We Are Not Alone. We're local investigators, as well as world-renowned scientists and ufologists, share their latest evidence in support of the UFO reality. Hi, I'm David Twitchell, and you're listening to WHFR Dearborn. WHFR.FM is the station making waves, and for the next hour, we will be exploring the mysteries of the UFO and abduction phenomenon. On March 25th, 1948, less than 1 year after the infamous Roswell incident, there was another alleged UFO crash near Aztec, New Mexico. As with Roswell, the debris was cleaned up and denied by the U.S. military. All attempts to publicize the incident were stonewalled by the powers that be, and the matter was soon became just another UFO myth. But after more than 25 years of investigation, Scott and Suzanne Ramsey have uncovered firsthand witness testimony and documentation that is converted that fiction into fact. In their compelling new book, The Aztec Incident, presents these facts in full detail. And we're happy to have Scott and Suzanne Ramsey on the line with us today to tell us, give us more information about the 1948 incident. Hello, Scott and Suzanne.
Hello, David. How are you?
I'm well.
Good. Thanks for having us.
Hey, no problem. We've had you on the show before quite a long time ago. I don't remember exactly when.
I think 2004.
2004.
Yep. Eight years ago.
8 years ago.
Seems like yesterday.
Now, I have been on the radio for 6 years, going on seven. So, you were on the TV version. That's why you were on the TV version, but I know I had you on the radio version.
You know what? Actually, I had the symposiums confused. It was at MUFON. We were on your show.
Yeah, we were on the TV version. I videotaped that for the TV version.
Yeah.
But I thought I had you on the radio show, but you're on the radio show now. You have this book out, and its title, once again, go ahead.
The Aztec Incident, Recovery at Heart Canyon.
Recovery at Heart Canyon. Okay. And Suzanne is with us.
He's sitting next to me.
Hello, Suzanne.
Hello.
How are you, Suzanne?
Oh, great. It's good to be here.
Hey, haven't talked to you in a while.
I know.
How have you been doing?
You know, we've been really doing well. It's been a busy time, and nice to have the book finished.
Yeah, I've been looking forward to it. I know Scott sent one to me, but I think the aliens beamed it up or something.
That will happen to you.
Yeah, I hear you. The government might have intercepted it. I don't know. But I don't know.
You know, over the last 25 years, well, I can speak for myself with 9 years, you just know anything's possible.
I hear you. Okay. So, question for either one of you. Most people really don't know much about the 1948 UFO crash at Aztec. So give our listeners a little history of the incident.
Sure. If you're not familiar, I'll start out a little bit and give you a little idea of about what area of New Mexico and a little bit what it's like out there. And then I'm going to pass the phone on and over to Scott, and he can take you from there for a little bit. And
okay.
We can go from move back and forth. How does that sound?
That sounds great.
The location of this incident was in the northwest corner of New Mexico, and it's called the Four Corners area, and that's where four states of Colorado, Arizona, New Mexico, and Utah meet. And you're up in the northwest corner of New Mexico. It's the high desert, so it's an elevation of a little bit over a mile high, and pretty rugged terrain up there. And at the time of the incident, it was 1948, and it was pretty rough and rugged, and it hasn't changed a whole lot. Of course, there's highways and some of the modern conveniences up there, but when you get out to where this actually incident happened, it's pretty rough and rugged. The roads are pretty intense and rough, and it has a real rugged beauty to it. Mm. You're so close to Colorado, you know, 20 miles to the border, that roughly, that you can see the beautiful mountains on one side of the site, and then the rest is desert, high desert. So you've got vegetation and things. So just kind of wanted to give you a picture of where you're at if you're not familiar with that part
right.
of the country.
But pretty desolate, huh?
Yeah. And back at the time of this incident, not a lot of phones, not a... you know, people were pretty sparsely populated, and it's not that heavily populated right now. Of course, the towns are, but once you get out there, you can go quite a distance and not see another person. So, you know, it's not like every part of the country that you're going to go to. It's a little bit different. Again, very, very beautiful area, but it's, you know, little different than other parts of this beautiful country.
Right.
I'm going to go ahead and pass you over to Scott, and he's going to walk you through the actual incident of itself, and I'm happy to help a little bit later,
any way
I can. Okay?
Feel free to jump in anytime.
I'll do it. Thanks.
All right.
And we're back.
And so what happened then out in this beautiful countryside?
Well, on March 25th, 1948, a little bit before 5 o'clock in the morning, two oil field workers, Bill Ferguson, Doug Noland, both with El Paso Oil Company at the time, were redirected out to Hart Canyon Road, where they have a had a series of drip tanks that were storage tanks at the base of a mesa. They were redirected out there because of a report from one of the oil field workers of a bad brush fire, and they feared the brush fire would endanger the drip tanks, which you can imagine what disaster that would be.
Really?
Anyway, they get out there shortly after 5 o'clock a.m., and the oil field workers that got there ahead of time said not to worry. The brush fire was above the oil tanks to the east, but they said to Bill Ferguson and Doug Nolan, we'd like you to come up on the mesa just to the west of the brush fire. There's something up here that has us baffled. And, of course, the long story short, it was a 100-foot diameter lenticular-shaped disc, brushed aluminum or pewter-colored, with no seams, rivets, weld marks, anything like that. To describe Doug Nolan, it looked as though this object had been molded.
Mm-hmm.
And a short while later, other people, other oil field workers, and a ranch family, Mr. and Mrs. Knight, who were running cattle out the Hart Canyon area, came by, and they went about proceeding to think that this was some type of experimental craft from the U.S. government, trying to get into the craft to see if there was anybody, survivors or anybody injured or just anybody in general.
All right.
So that's how the story starts. We were lucky enough to interview Doug Nolan before he died back in 2003. And over the years, coming upon different people involved in it, it showed that there was some credibility in the story.
Okay. So Doug Nolan, and what's the other guy's name?
Bill Ferguson.
Bill Ferguson. You weren't able to interview Ferguson?
No, unfortunately, Bill had died years ago.
Okay. But Nolan was a eyewitness, correct? First-hand eyewitness?
That is correct, yep. He was one of the first ones at the scene.
Okay. Now, what again was his function? He worked for what?
He worked for El Paso Oil Company, kind of a... basically a roughneck. He had just started with the company several months before.
Mm-hmm.
He moved down to the Aztec area from Mancos, Colorado, and was basically just starting out as a young 19-year-old man in the oil patch business.
Hmm. How old was he when you talked to him?
Golly.
Old, huh?
He was up in his 80s, yeah. He had had a series of strokes. And Suzanne and I actually, we got married in October, and we're going to fly out to see him in December and interview him firsthand instead of over the phone like we had done.
Mm.
And we knew his health was getting worse and worse and worse because of the strokes.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, he died about a week before we got out there.
Okay, but you did interview him over the phone.
Oh, absolutely. We also have... close to 3 hours, about 2 hours and 45 minutes of interview with him that a friend of ours did.
Hmm. Personally?
Yes, personally, right.
Okay. So you would say that he was a credible witness?
Oh, very, yeah.
Hmm. It's not like he had been talking about this incident in his 80s or in his 70s, but all of his life?
He had told a certain group of select people about it throughout the years, and then Suzanne and I went and talked to them, and they backed up his story that this story hadn't wavered or changed over the years, that it was the same consistent story.
Mm-hmm. So, okay, so they go out to this this disc-shaped object, and then what else did they see there?
Well, Bill Ferguson... was the first to go up there and discover what looked like a mirrored, the best way Doug described it to us is sort of like the mirrored sunglasses that were popular back in the 70s.
All right.
I guess they still are in certain parts of the country.
All right.
Yeah, and they found a port. The portholes were very mirrored looking. This is long before that technology came into the sunglasses. And they found a porthole with about a half-inch size hole. They have no idea. We still have no idea what would have caused that decompression. The thing was shot at. Who knows? And they started poking around and actually were able to release a staircase on this craft.
A staircase?
Yes.
And it came down to the ground?
Yes, it did.
Okay, they're poking around where? Outside?
They're poking around in what would be the upper cabin portion of the craft.
How did they get in?
Well, you kind of at the beginning had mentioned that this was debris field all over, comparing it to Roswell.
Yeah.
And that's not the case. The Aztec saucer was intact.
Okay, now, my comparison was the fact that in 47, a disc crashed in Roswell. And in 48, another disc crashed in Aztec, New Mexico. Well, there was no as I understand the Aztec crash, there was no debris field, just a solid craft.
That's correct. Yep,
okay.
Absolutely.
So now, you say that they were poking around. We're still talking about Aztec, right?
Yep. Ferguson's up on top of the leading edge,
okay.
And they're looking in through these mirrored windows.
Right.
And he's poking around with an oil field pole.
Oh, okay. He's
poking around. I'm sorry.
Okay.
We should probably warn your listening audience that you can hear me fine, and I can barely hear you. And I apologize for that.
Okay.
We've had a series of very, very bad thunderstorms down here in North Carolina.
Okay. Well, just ask me to repeat then.
That's fine. I'm sorry. Bear with us.
But when you said poking around, I thought they got inside and started messing with buttons and levers and stuff.
Now, once they found the broken porthole, Bill Ferguson, still more concerned that this was something that was a U.S. aircraft or a prototype. You know, keeping in mind, New Mexico at the time is still a hotbed today, as it was back then, for experimental aircraft. White Sands Proving Ground back then, White Sands Missile Range today.
Right.
So that was the whole mindset with Bill and Doug and the other oil field workers, is, my God, whatever's landed up here, let's see if there's anybody inside that needs help. And in the book, we have pictures of that era. But the oil field trucks at that time, they carried poles and fire poles. The oil field trucks were also a form of fire equipment.
All right.
In case you had a fire at your oil rig, you'd better be able to fight the fire as well. And during this knocking around inside the cabin with the fire pole, they activated a staircase.
I see. Okay, so the staircase comes down.
Right.
And they went up, I assume.
Yes, they did.
What'd they find?
Two small humanoid but childlike bodies slumped over a control panel.
Okay.
And then upper level, a lower level as the staircase came down, with 12 to 14 other humanoid child-looking bodies.
All dead?
Yes.
See, the Roswell incident, there was allegedly one being that survived, but not in this case, right?
No.
Okay.
Now, not to the opinion of a 19-year-old kid at the time. He said they all looked like they had been charred through either some kind of heat or decompression.
Wow.
And that was Doug's description. They looked charred.
But outside of this little hole in the porthole that he was able to stick that pole through, there was no evidence that it was shot at, no bullet inside, or...
Over the years, Doug really had a lot of trouble trying to figure out what would have brought this craft down.
Mm-hmm.
And as we did our research, we found that there were many incidents, not an isolated case, of these flying discs and the green orbs from back in the late 40s and 50s flying over installations like Kirkland, Sandia, Los Alamos National Lab. And we go into detail on that in the book. Was Dr. Lincoln La Paz, who was with the University of New Mexico, was actually hired by the Air Force to explain what these objects were. Were they hard craft, nuts and bolts, or were these illusions people were seeing, or were they meteorites? And in doing our research, we found that Los Alamos had actually filed some reports on these large structured-type craft that had been flying over Los Alamos in March of 1948.
And Los Alamos dealt with atomic bombs, atomic energy, is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. That was the founding home of the Manhattan Project that developed the first nuclear weapon.
Interesting.
Roswell, of course, being the only bomber group in 47 that had atomic weapons, and New Mexico was sort of a hotbed as we did the research to see that UFO sightings were a relatively common occurrence.
Mm-hmm. Along with the nuclear bomb testing.
Yes, that's correct.
So it all comes back, virtually every show that I do, it all hints at our nuclear weapons and our nuclear power.
Mm-hmm.
Nuclear power plants, they seem to have great interest in our nuclear facilities.
Yes, there is a tie to that.
And I've said it before, I think it was Stanton Friedman that said it, that they're looking at it like the kids have found the matches.
Yeah, exactly.
So, I need to take minute here just to remind our listeners that you're listening to WHFR.FM, the only station making waves. I'm David Twitchell, and you're listening to We Are Not Alone. Today we're speaking with Scott and Suzanne Ramsey. They are researchers, UFO researchers, and authors of the book, The Aztec Incident. And once again, we were talking about the fact that these little guys, if they are little guys, like to hang around our nuclear facilities, nuclear-powered sub. Well, Nautilus, right?
I'm sorry, David?
The nuclear sub, the Nautilus?
Yes.
Yeah, they hung around that.
Yeah.
Allegedly. I mm-hmm. keep saying allegedly, but I mean... I have no hard proof of this, the whole thing, but except for what I saw, you know. And when I saw, I can't prove. Even if I had a camera with me at the time, you know, everybody would say, well, of course, this was 62. I don't think they would say, you did that on your computer, But at any rate, we had no nuclear weapons in our home, so I guess they hang around other places. Back to you, Scott and Suzanne.
Okay.
Okay, so they find these little bodies, and then what happens? Do they notify anyone, or...?
No, nobody notifies anybody. There's no phones out there or anything. I don't want to spend a lot of time on this in the interest of an hour, because there's 13 chapters of the book that I think your listeners will find interesting.
Okay.
But basically, there are two police officers at the scene. One has followed this object throughout the night, and he was driving up Highway 44 and following it in his patrol truck, I'll call it, because they didn't have police cars in his town. And his name was Manuel Sandoval. And then another local police officer shows up at the scene that had a report of it coming near the town. And so you've got two police officers there. You've got oil field workers. And then we designate a chapter in the book to a Baptist preacher that shows up at the crash site after seeing a lot of activity out in Hart Canyon Road. And so there's so much more to the book as you get into it. I mean, this is the third book written on the Aztec incident. The first one was written by Frank Scully. I don't know if you've ever had the chance to read that. It's a very interesting book.
No. I've heard of Frank Scully.
Yeah, it's titled Behind the Flying Saucers.
Mm-hmm.
And then Bill Steinman wrote a book back in 87, or actually 86, it came out in 87, called The Aztec Incident. And he and Wendell Stevens did a lot of research on that.
Mm-hmm.
And very good book. It was a self-published book. It had some success. It actually gained more popularity back in the late 90s, after there was a new interest in the Aztec.
Mm.
But so what our book does, it's a collection of interviews with people that claim that they were there. It's a look back on Frank Scully's work and claims he made in 1950, just 2 years after the incident.
Mm.
And we look at Bill Steinman's book, and we compare it to what we were able to find in what I call modern-day research.
Okay. Now, who exactly was Frank Scully, and why was he made the heavy in this case?
Frank Scully was a very well-known writer back at the time. He wrote for Variety magazine.
Hmm.
And more kind of followed the Hollywood scene. He's kind of the leading edge journalist. I'm trying to think who I'd compare him to today. But anyway, he was very well respected, and he was approached by a group of scientists that came to him and said that they had the story that they really wanted him to break because of his notoriety. And it got his attention, and, you know, they said this is concerning a recovered flying saucer that landed 11 miles to the northeast of the town of Aztec.
Hmm.
And Scully never divulged who these scientists were, but we designate a whole chapter in the book based on clues that he left in the book of who they were. And, yeah, I don't, you know, obviously in 1950, never knowing the access that you and I and your listening audience would have to the internet and retrieving data from universities and going in with the Freedom of Information Act and archival research, just taking the clues and the descriptions of these men that worked on the Manhattan Project, it wasn't really that difficult. It took a lot of time to piece together who these gentlemen were.
Right. But for some reason, they did make Scully the heavy. I mean, they made out like he was lying about the whole thing. Do I have that right?
No. That was J.P. Kahn from the San Francisco Chronicle.
Oh, okay. I got him mixed up.
He was the one that debunked Scully's story.
Okay.
And an interesting way he did that, that's a good point you brought up, he did it by daring Scully to cough up who these scientists were.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, to the day he died, he never did divulge who they were.
Mm. Well,
but he left some very good clues in the book, and I'll give you, for instance, he described the one as having more degrees than a thermometer, and actually, if you put all these composite scientists together and you look at the PhDs they had and honorary PhDs, it was very impressive.
Mm-hmm.
And we went through all the scientists that worked on the OSRD, which was part of the parent of the Manhattan Project,
mm-hmm.
during World War II, and taking clues that he said about each one, we were able to piece together what we think is a very accurate group.
Hmm. It wouldn't have been the Majestic 12, would it?
Well, you know, I you wonder if there's a correlation between that.
Yeah. Hmm.
You really do, and in looking at some of these scientists, one gentleman of interest from University of Minnesota was Dr. Jonathan Torrance Tate.
Mm-hmm.
And last summer, as we were finalizing the book, Suzanne and I spent some time up there at the university going through their archives and looking at the incredible work that he did. Some of it's still very classified 60-plus years later.
Wow.
but the top shelf projects that they worked on to help end the war. And it was no secret that Dr. Tate did, in fact, work for the Manhattan Project, and kind of fits the bill of what Scully talked about in 1950.
Hmm. Okay, so what about the cleanup? Maybe Suzanne can tell me about the cleanup. What did they do with this craft?
I could pass you to her in a minute. She kind of stepped away.
Ah, she gave
the,
up?
we're not sure where the craft went. We've speculated that forever. Hmm. A couple of likely places being not that far away would have been Los Alamos.
Right, I would think. Uh-huh. You know, but, of course, how did they get it there?
We designate a chapter in the book to, it's titled Moving the Craft.
Hmm.
And in 2008, we actually hired world-renowned expert on moving large equipment, and we went out to the crash site and did a mock reenactment of moving an object at that size. And now Scully did say the craft came apart and gave out specific sizes in his book.
Hmm.
And assuming everything in Scully's original report in 1950 was accurate, based on that is how we did the mock reenactment.
Okay.
And we found it was quite feasible. As a matter of fact, it went from looking to be impossible with a flatbed truck, and we, of course, only could utilize technology from 1948.
All right.
But Bill Metzger writes in the book, he actually wrote his own report, that on a scale of 1 to 10, using 1948 technology, it was about a 3.
Hmm.
As a matter of fact, the military wouldn't have needed a guy with his expertise with all the resources that they had at their fingertips.
But you say this craft was able to come apart? It came apart?
Yeah, yep.
If it had no seams...
Go through that in the book of how they claim it came apart in segments.
If it had no seams, no rivets,
Doug Nolan said when the staircase came down, it almost appeared to come out of nowhere.
Huh.
That they couldn't even see where the staircase, you know, had been when it was retracted in the up position.
Right. I have heard people describe that as, you know, there's no seams, no rivets. You can't see anything. And all of a sudden, this staircase or ladder or whatever they want to call it seems to come out of nowhere.
Yeah, sure.
And so at the scene, how many witnesses, eyewitnesses, would you estimate were at the scene before they said, get out of here?
Military showed up about mid-morning.
Okay.
The second police officer that arrived, which was a local police officer, warned everybody at the site that the military had been... had been advised of this object laying up there and told all the oil field workers and Mr. and Mrs. Knight, who were the more senior people that were ranching at the time, to leave the scene immediately. Hmm. And basically these 19 and 20 and 25-year-old young men said that they refused to leave, that their company at least had oil field leases out there, and they felt there was no reason to leave, and they basically disobeyed the police and said, no, we're not leaving.
Then
and late morning, the military showed up and broke the guys up individually and talked to them. And I don't want to say threaten them. I think that's a little strong. But read them their security oath and reminded them that we had just come off World War II and that this object should not be talked about.
Hmm. I assume they were trying to convince them that this craft was one of ours.
You know, Doug said they never really did either way.
No.
It's just basically forget what you saw up here.
Yeah, basically. Of course, they couldn't convince them that these the occupants were one of ours, could they?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So there was just like the two cops, other than the military, there was a two
yeah,
cops.
There was four, 14 people at the crash site, the best we can account for.
14 people. How many of those 14 were you able to get a statement from or interview?
Over the years, three.
Three?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. All credible witnesses.
Yeah, and it's kind of funny. I think Stan Friedman and I, over the years, Stan was not a big fan of the Aztec story. He, like other researchers, had written it off over the years. Stan was generous enough to come and donate his speaking time at the Aztec UFO Symposium that they used to have up until last year. But over the years, as I'd share information with Stan for his evaluation and his take on it, it became apparent to us and Suzanne and I, when we got married, looking at the evidence, all these young men that were at the crash site were all became very, very successful later on in life.
Oh.
And I always wonder what the odds are on that.
You mean like the police officers?
Yes, they one became a very successful rancher, if we're correct on that, on the identity of him. Doug Nolan went on to move to Vegas, and he built a very successful assay business. Bill Ferguson went on to have a very successful trucking company. And it's just kind of amazing in that era, if you had that group of guys in 19 to 25 age bracket, what are the odds that many would go on to be very, very successful?
What are you suggesting?
I think maybe they were given some help over the years.
Some money, you
mean? It goes back to the Roswell with Mac Brazel.
Right.
Remember the new truck right after the military interviewed him?
Right.
Do you remember what he did later in life?
No.
He had the largest, most modern meatpacking plant in New Mexico.
And at the time of the Roswell crash, it was just a very simple ranch.
I think somebody told me he was making $6 a month and was given free room, board, and feed.
Good Lord.
Yeah, his plant is still visible. It's outside the town of Carrizozo, by the way.
Well, I saw a UFO. If any government people with money are listening, pay me and I'll shut up. Otherwise,
exactly,
I will keep my show.
Suzanne is back and sitting next to me if you wanted to ask her some questions.
Right. Okay, thanks.
I'm going to hand you over. Here you go.
Hi again, Suzanne.
Hello.
Tell me, what kind of documentation is there that you come across in your research that indicates that there really was a crash at Aztec?
It's been really exciting. We, in the book cover... Well, let me explain what the documentation we've done.
Mm-hmm.
Anything that we've discussed in the book is documented. And we don't, of course, there are things that we found that we didn't have a document, and so, honestly, we just deleted them. We didn't put them in the book.
Really?
But the whole book is based on the documentation. We have gathered over 55,000 documents that are directly and indirectly related to it.
Mm.
So... we've got things from, help me out, hon. Boy, the list is.
FBI correspondence on it.
FBI, Army, Air Force, Air Corps, CIA, a sting operation, do pictures. All different avenues. And I tell you what, there's the last one that I got to work on directly was last year, just before we started to try to put the book together. And we were at the University of Minnesota, and we were doing some research on Dr. Torrence Tate. And it's amazing. I don't know if you've had the opportunity to do something like that, but a lot of the archives that you go into, you wear the white gloves. It's things that nobody else has seen, for decades and decades. Or maybe once they were closed, they just never were opened by anyone. No one had an interest.
Yeah.
And to be going through those and to see something tied into Aztec is so exhilarating. Here we are in this library, in these archives, and quiet, and I look at Scott, and you just want to jump up. It's so exciting. It's almost like treasure hunting. It's really been a pleasure and a joy.
Yeah.
But, you know, those little jewels only come along once in a while. There's a lot of time and energy spent, as you can imagine, you know,
but
in between.
You say the Air Force, you've come across documentation about this incident by the Air Force and CIA. Are they mentioning that something actually happened?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
What are they saying? Some of them, actually, and Scott can quote that specifically for you, but David needs to know about the specifically quoting on the Air Force and the FBI and things directly quoting.
No, not specifically, but in general, what did they say, yeah, something crashed there, or nothing happened, or what?
They're actually, we put these in the book. They're included in the book. But they're conversations about what to do, setting up a sting operation for someone that has pictures.
A sting operation. I was going to ask about that. You mean they're trying to catch people that had photographs of this thing?
There's, at one point, and this part's in the book, and it just stirs your soul, is you're seeing correspondence back and forth about a reporter, and he is undercover and claims that he has photographs, and they're want to look into what he's got, and they say they actually set up a sting operation. They go and meet him, and evidently he gets wind of what's happening, and he says to him, "Oh no, I was drunk. I really don't have photographs." And then in later correspondence, the statement that you see them make is, "But we don't believe him.
Yeah.
We believe he's got them."
Yeah.
And so, you know, if there was nothing to it, it's kind of hard to have even those conversations.
Right. They wanted to lay their hands on those pictures, right?
Yep.
So they could fall through the cracks, right?
I tell you what, I wouldn't mind getting my hands on those pictures.
I hear you. Well, you know, if they haven't surfaced yet, I will bet you, cookie to a donut, that they will surface one day.
You know, you never know. We have heard and understand from certain individuals that they do, and we would be more than happy to look at them if they are. We would be thrilled, but we have not come across them yet.
Mm-hmm.
Have a pretty good sense of some folks that probably have them, but
really,
yeah,
like Wendell Stevens. Now he's passed now.
Right, Wendell's passed.
Yeah, but he had a ton of pictures.
Yeah, I don't know that Wendell had pictures of it. Not to my knowledge. When we visited with him, that was not the case.
Nice.
But it's, you know, it's been a joy to, you know, Bill Steinman, for him to have conversations with us back and forth and visit with us for how many years, hon? 19 and a half years. And, you know, he went through some real strain and struggle due to his research, and really has moved himself away from it completely. And we were honored that he would continue a conversation with us and share things that he knew after his book was published, or things that he didn't feel comfortable talking about, and leads and things. And so that was a joy, and for him to actually write in the book and to be pleased enough with the book that he felt good with it. And then Stanton Friedman, as Scott said too, who Stanton always had it in his gray basket. And if you know Stanton Friedman, his he always has a white, a black, and a gray basket.
Right.
And ours was in the middle in the gray. He was just on the fence. And based on the information, as a lot of researchers had heard, they were on the fence, or they, you know, took what had been previously presented. And Stanton actually wrote foreword? He wrote the foreword in the book.
Mm.
And what's exciting, though, is to be able to feel like we left no stone unturned. And, you know, to the best that we possibly can, we don't actually have the craft, and that's disappointing, but...
Yeah.
But to actually be able to document it and see how many people years later are still working on this, government agencies and things, is a thrill. I mean, it's an important part of history, David, that has been overlooked.
Right.
And I truly believe that it has touched every person and every being on this earth, the impact of this, whether you're in a civilized civilization or not, and whether you have any inkling of it or not, it has had an impact.
Right.
With not things that they've learned and gained and grown from. And the fact that it was an intact craft, and they had the world's, you know, best scientists working on it, and how that impacted their lives. And that's one of the things, too. You know, there's the initial incident, but then, and you think it's out in the middle of New Mexico, or, you know, out in New Mexico, and then from nowhere, you start to see how it was turned into a myth or a hoax by people that wanted to cover it up, but also through J.P. Kahn. J.P. Kahn is a person, and you touched on that just a little bit, who was an author and wanted the information, and he spoke to Frank Scully and said, love to have the information, and he told his paper, I'm sure I can get it for $10,000, and he was bragging. Well, J.P. Kahn, with all the research that we've done and interviewing people that knew him and things, was a very, very wealthy man, a man that never had to work a day in his life. He was independently wealthy, passed on by his parents, and he had, you know, the time and money to discredit people. And what you start to see and how this became proclaimed as a hoax was the steps that this man had, again, the time and money to go ahead and start to cover up and discredit people as he went. And when you look at it that way, it knocks your socks off. And again, that's all stuff that we can prove because we have it. We have the documents. But
so you know,
it is amazing how powerful something like that can be. Sorry, didn't mean to interrupt you.
No, I was just going to say, you have the documentation to show that this Kahn character did indeed discredit an honest man.
Several honest men.
Okay.
The scientists jeopardized their lives. You know, it's so much richer of a story, not that the fact that it happened is a very rich story, but then there's so many people's lives that were directly impacted and turned around and twisted because of not the incident so much, but J.P. Kahn's, I guess you could call it the Wrath of Kahn. Oh, I never got that before.
I like that one. You're into puns, Suzanne. I like that.
I know. Well, I get so pumped up on this. I tell you what, it is so exciting.
And
to be able to share this piece of history.
Yeah. Yeah, this sounds like a book that, you know, try again to get that book to me, please, because...
We will. We'll... Okay.
Do it through the underground.
I'll do it.
So the government doesn't steal it from me. I have to take one more break just to remind our listeners that you're listening to WHFR.FM, the station making waves here in Dearborn, Michigan, out of Henry Ford Community College, 89.3 FM on your radio and WHFR.FM on your computer. And you're listening to We Are Not Alone. I am David Twitchell, and we're speaking with Scott and Suzanne Ramsey, researchers and authors of the Aztec Incident, colon recovery at Heart Canyon. Is that correct?
Yes.
Recovery at Heart Canyon. That sounds great. I was going to ask you something. What was it? Yeah, you know, it's funny you said we've left no stone unturned. One of my questions is, do you feel you've left no stone unturned? And when you said that, I said, ooh, well, it stole my question.
Well, we sure have tried. And what we, as folks that have really valued research our whole lives, both of us individually, and we were raised in families that value it, our thoughts were to look at things from a... skeptical side,
right,
and not just to prove what we wanted to prove, and I'm always leery of someone like that. That if they're trying to sell me something, whether it's a book or information or a car, you know, I just give me the information. I'm capable of making my own decision,
right.
And I feel, and Scott does too, that
that's how most people are. If you were given an intelligent mind and the ability to make decisions for ourselves, and we hope that we were able to provide people with good information, and then they can make up their own mind. That's our hopes. And in terms of looking at things from a skeptical standpoint, looking and seeing what possibly could you look at that or address that hasn't been addressed that could make this, more legitimate. And is there something that's missing? And we're happy to do that. That's really where our focus has been.
Yeah. Open-minded skepticism. I welcome that.
We do, too. And, when it comes to people being skeptics, we are actually very excited about that. When somebody brings up something, if they've read the book or they're familiar with our research, then we actually get excited at the challenge. It just raises the bar.
Right.
However, I will tell you, there are people out there that it's just funny. We were scheduled this year to have our book come out in April 16th.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a snag and a delay, and it actually didn't come out till about the middle of May.
Hmm.
And
always.
It's funny because we had not even gotten the book back so that we could proof it.
Hmm.
And there was a skeptic out and talking about how we didn't know what we were talking about and what a terrible book it was, and did a book review. And it was a month before we even, it was actually about 3 weeks before we actually got to do a proof on it. We hadn't even seen the finished, the proof copy on it.
That is funny.
Miracles are out there, I guess, huh?
Yeah. Well, you ought to do your own article on that. Do the article on the guy that did the article before the book even came out.
That's exactly right.
I have read the title, and they don't know what they're talking about. People do that with my book, UFO Jesus Connection. That's a terrible book. How can you write such a book? I ask them, what chapter did you find most offensive? I didn't read it.
Mm-hmm.
So
this says it all, doesn't it?
Yeah,
it does. Like I was saying earlier, if somebody's got something that's genuine and true to bring to the table, we're excited. It only makes us better. But if you're just shooting off your mouth, and I'm afraid, I hate to say it, that I see that a lot with the Internet nowadays, that people have a tendency to either believe everything that's on the Internet or that being their only source of research. And, a lot of times the research is just opinion.
Yeah, tell me about it. Yeah, some of the stuff I see on the Internet and emails. Especially political things. You hear what this politician did. Did you hear about what that politician did?
Yeah.
And they never did a darn thing,
And I think people are smart enough to make up their own decision,
Then usually politicians don't do a darn thing, so.
Yeah, that's right. That's exactly right.
So what was the, I was going to ask you, symbols. Did they find any symbols on the outside or inside of this craft?
I'm going to give that to Scott, and he can address that. It's kind of an exciting part, but I did want to mention real quick, we're probably getting short on time, but I wanted to mention that the Dearborn and Gaylord area, we used to vacation up there very often, and what a beautiful, beautiful area.
It is nice, isn't it?
Just love it.
Yeah.
Just love it.
Yeah.
I'm going to pass the phone over to Scott, and David and his audience are interested in symbols, if they saw symbols. I'm going to pass the phone over. Okay?
Thank you.
Thanks so much.
Bye-bye.
She had to give her little commercial in the Dearborn Flint area, huh?
Yeah, Dearborn Gaylord, she said.
Gaylord, I'm sorry, yeah. yes, there was... Frank Scully goes into detail in his book, and we touch on it just a little bit, and the reason we only touch on it a little bit is because we weren't able to talk to anybody firsthand about any symbols or writings in the book, or in the craft, until, of course, the book came out.
Okay.
And then a gentleman came forward and said that he thought his father had worked on trying to encrypt some of the pamphlets, as he put it, or books that were found on board.
Oh, there were books and pamphlets.
He used the word pamphlets to use his quote.
Okay.
And actually, you know, you get a lot of these phone calls and a lot of these emails. This gentleman, without giving away who he is, because with a lot of work we have to do yet, he's pretty high up with NASA.
Hmm.
And we've already looked into his father's background. His father is deceased, but his father was a cryptologist during World War II.
Hmm.
And he feels that this was something his father worked on, because as his father grew older, he possibly talked about something like this.
Hmm.
So we've got a lot of work to do in that area, but I don't want to use the word hieroglyphics, but an odd writing was found inside the craft.
Okay. Well, on these craft, they often compare them to hieroglyphics.
Yes, they do. Yeah.
But they say, you know, those that are able to read hieroglyphics say, no, they are not hieroglyphics.
Exactly. But, that's why I said I use that word carefully.
Yeah, but something similar to.
Yep.
That symbols.
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 Yeah. Symbols versus
saying.
What we would call letters, or, you know, vice versa.
Right. Well, what are our letters but symbols, you know?
Yep, exactly.
So.
We've got some great leads since the book's out. We only printed 1,100 books, and I don't know if your listening audience knows where to get it, but they can look at the website, www.theaztecincident.com, and they can actually read the foreword, the preface, the introduction of the book. It's right there online. They can read that part of the book for free.
Mm-hmm.
And kind of get their appetite wet to see if they want to go any further and purchase the book.
Yeah. Yeah, I have read that. I went online and I read that, and it certainly did whet my appetite for this. And now this interview has whet my appetite even more. As I told Suzanne, tell Scott, send me the book again.
Yeah, and I went back and found out when I did it. It was right after you and I corresponded.
Wow.
But, yeah, you'll have one here by the middle of next week, and after you read it and take your highlighter to it, then maybe we can come back on and you can grill us for an hour or so.
It sounds great. But we do have a couple more minutes. I wanted to ask you what the official explanation of the incident was, if any, other than it didn't happen.
Well, you know, when you look through, it's a great question, and you know, Roswell, they weather ballooned that one.
Yeah.
And Aztec, it's kind of funny. The FBI writes it off as a hoax after they investigated it for at least 3 years. I don't know if the FBI would investigate anything for that amount of time before they came to that conclusion.
Yeah.
The Army CID, in all our Freedom of Information Acts, was the only very difficult group to deal with. They would send me very nice letters denying me access to any of the ones that I was requesting.
Mm.
And why I was requesting them is because at one point the Army, the CIA, and the Air Force were working together on that sting operation Suzanne mentioned.
All right.
And they were saying they had no involvement. And I said, well, here's the Air Force document saying that you were involved in it. So it's...
What did they say to that?
We don't have those files anymore. After 50 years, we're allowed to destroy everything. And thank you very much for your interest in the United States Army Counterintelligence Division. Have a nice day.
After 50 years, we're allowed to destroy everything. We're not allowed.
They claim the Air Force says certain documents you're allowed to destroy, but not all. And by the way, the United States Air Force was the most wonderful group, along with the FBI, I may add, in getting us documents.
The Air Force was?
Absolutely. They were wonderful.
Great. That's great. But the CIA, the FBI, they said no, don't.
The FBI and the Air Force, they rank one and two of the nicest people to work with.
Okay.
And everybody else was very polite, but more of a bureaucracy.
Yeah, yeah. What did you expect, you know?
Yeah.
So,
but, I mean, Suzanne and I have been down to Maxwell Air Force Base Archives, and they're just absolutely wonderful people. They you know, about knock themselves out to help you.
Well, that is great. That's encouraging, actually.
Mm-hmm. You know? That doesn't mean they give you everything you ask for.
No.
And I understand why, but at least they're very nice in explaining, sorry, you can't have that.
But there's physical evidence right there at Aztec, right at the site, that shows that something happened.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. And we have erected a plaque. We did that back in 1998. Mm-hmm. So when people are out in the Aztec area, it's a very, very beautiful part of the country. If you get out there and you want to really work up your heart rate, go out Heart Canyon Road.
Mm-hmm.
I highly recommend a high center four-wheel drive vehicle.
All right.
If you fly into the area, Hertz rental car at Farmington has the only high center rental car or rental vehicles. They have them for the oil fields. Highly recommend. That's where you get yours.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very rugged terrain. Go out, and the visitor center in Aztec has a map how to get to the crash site. You can park your car up in an area and hike out, and we've erected a plaque out there that people can read a brief overview of what happened.
Very good. Scott and Suzanne Ramsey, I want to thank you very much for joining us on We Are Not Alone and telling us about the Aztec incident.
Thanks so much for having us on, Dave.
And tell Suzanne I said so long.
Okay, take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And if our listeners have any questions or comments for me, you can email me at dtwitchell@hotmail.com. This show, as well as all the forum shows, is now archived at whfr.fm's website. Click on the forum button on the homepage. We Are Not Alone is also archived at my website, ufoimplications.com. That's ufoimplications.com. Please stay tuned to whfr.fm, the station making waves, for the best in alternative programming. I want to thank you for joining us today. Please join us again the first Tuesday of each month at 1 p.m. when we will again explore the mysteries of the UFO phenomenon. Until then, this is David Twitchell reminding you to keep an eye on the sky.
Good afternoon. This is WHFR Dearborn. You're listening to the program called the Rockabilly Rodeo Show. I'm Mike Holloway. I'll be your host for the next 2 hours, featuring only some great rockabilly music just for your listening pleasure. Today, we'll start off the show with the Luster Kings doing the song called Bopalina.
Boop, Scooby-Doo-Balina, go, gal, go, Bopalina, Bopalina. Papalina, Papalina.